You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Something's coming.
Stand by.
Hold on to your hats. Here we go.
Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 135. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is Brad Henderson.
Again, I feel like we've been on 135 for 20 episodes. Can we get out of the 130s? I mean, I don't understand.
We will soon. Five more episodes, we'll be out.
Well, I don't believe it.
BJ Colangelo is making some goddamn movie that all you assholes paid for. So it's all your fault. She can't join us.
Losers. Give it your
she
money.
She is... balls deep in pre-production for Powerbomb, and they're going to be recording.
They should change the name to Bomb Power.
Bomb Power. They are going to be doing some starting principal photography soon. They're in pre-production right now, so we are super excited for her. So
yeah.
That's what's going on with BJ.
Fetzy.
But today we have a very special guest joining us, director of Pool Party Massacre. Is Drew Marvick. What's up, man?
Hello.
Thank you so much for hanging out. I thought we were just going to do like a little bullshit interview, but you're in it for the long haul. You're going to hang out on the podcast.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I was told, at least.
Right.
That's another lie. Oh, man.
So basically what we're going to do here for the next 2 hours is just rip your movie apart.
2 hours. Jesus Christ.
If you don't leave crying, we haven't done our job.
Oof.
I'm just kidding. We fucking love the movie. Who am I kidding?
It was a really good setup, Sean.
Yeah. So, Drew, welcome to the Screamcast.
Thank you so much. By the way, I could spend 2 hours ripping it apart if you really wanted to.
you're an artist. That's what most artists do, is they birth something in the world and then they... rip it to shreds and wish they would have done things differently. Kind of, you know, the same thing with parents. You bring a child in the... I'm just kidding. Here we go.
Whoa.
This isn't my
Casey
weekly
Anthony
therapy
shit.
Session.
Oh, that was probably too soon. I'm sorry.
We'll be talking about Pool Party Massacre in depth in a little bit. But first, let's find out what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow. I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
I want to know what's on Drew's doorstep. Drew, what have you watched lately that's badass?
Oh, God. You guys actually watch movies, too?
I thought you
just talked about them.
Barely.
What we do is we read Wikipedia, and then we basically read the Wikipedia entry.
Sean.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I've noticed that. I have had a ton on my doorstep, but I haven't had any time to watch anything. I have a gigantic stack of... Well, I still have a stack of movies from Orlando, or from Tampa, I should say, from Grindhouse Video, that's so ridiculously tall, and I haven't opened a single one of them.
Ooh. What did you pick up, at least?
I picked up the house set.
Yeah.
The house 1 and 2 set, which I'm dying to watch. I picked up Dreamstalker from Intervision.
Oh, dude, that's so good.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Mine's still sealed. I picked up a copy of Just Before Dawn. Because a random fan of Pool Party Massacre sent me an email telling me that I should remake it. And I could barely remember seeing it, so I bought it. He also went into detail about how I should kill everyone in the sequel of Pool Party Massacre, but I think that's a whole nother episode of the podcast. Like, literally extensive detail of what weapons I should use and what mask I should wear. So,
did this guy breathe heavy from his mouth?
I don't know. There was just an email.
Oh,
But
I thought it was the one in Tampa. Where were we? Orlando? Somewhere.
He might have been there. I mean, I wish I knew who he was, because then I would feel safer speaking about him. Right now, I'm kind of nervous that I even brought it up. So I apologize if you're listening.
He's not.
I also got the Phantasm collection.
And you're killing it, Drew.
I did. I spent every dollar I made at the convention at Grindhouse Video. I got American Guinea Pig Blood Shock.
Okay.
And the last thing I got was Frames of Fear from SRS.
Yeah, they're doing some cool work over there at SRS. It's too bad they don't have like a bigger, like they distribute more, because they only like make like 50 or 100 copies of their shit and then they close it down.
But yeah, I don't know exactly what Ron is doing.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few of, like, I have gore horror and stuff like that, but, like, it seems that, they limit so much. I mean, I understand its cost, and I don't know if it's really, like, that, you know, people are hounding for those titles, especially some shot-on-video stuff from the, you know, fucking late 90s. But anyways, yeah, they do some good work. They've done some Blu-rays, too. But, yeah.
Sweet.
And that's all. Lloyd Kaufman convinced me to buy a banana motherfucker on my way out of the convention too, but I haven't watched that yet either.
Wait, did they make a movie out of Banana Motherfucker, or is it just the trailer?
Well, I have a DVD, so I hope it's not just the trailer.
It's like the Hardware Wars thing where, like, there's that Hardware Wars old, you know, trailer, and it's always released in special edition DVDs, and it's like 2 minutes long.
Yeah, knowing Lloyd Kaufman, it's just the trailer.
It does say that the runtime is 50 minutes.
Huh.
I didn't know they made Banana Motherfucker into a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when that trailer hit, and I was fucking, like, fucking laughing hysterically. But I didn't know they made that into, like, a somewhat feature.
Well, they did.
Oh, I'm going to have to look at that and watch it.
Me too.
Maybe get down and dirty.
Nice.
Oh, what's on your doorstep?
All right, I'll go quickly, Brad, because mine's quick. And then you can have the floor.
If you talk about the fucking Da Vinci Code, I swear to fucking God.
I'm not going
to
talk about the Da Vinci Code. I don't know the Da Vinci Code. I've watched that. I'm done. I've watched the entire trilogy, and I'm done with that. I'll never have to watch it again. Here we go. I did want to mention really quick.
You're going to be Da Vinci Code.
No.
Okay.
There's Angels and Demons. There's a World War II. I think it's World War II film called Allied with Brad Pitt and Marianne Cotillard, directed by Robert Zemeckis, and it looks like this kind of bullshit romantic drama, but it's, if you like World War II flicks, like, it's actually pretty decent. I'm surprised at, like, the gore that Robert Zemeckis does in this. It's probably his best movie since, like, Castaway. So just kind of throwing that out there. It's not necessarily a horror movie, but there's some of the violence. I was actually really happy that he went pretty hardcore on it. So it's a really cool shootout during, like, a Nazi dinner party. It's pretty awesome. But if you're into that sort of thing. But I don't want to spend too much time on it. But, you know, like I said, best Robert Zemeckis flick in a long time. And that's all I got to say about that. Moving along, though, Jackson Stewart directed a film called Beyond the Gates. And stars, of course, Barbara Crampton is in it, starring Graham Skipper, Chase Williamson, and the lovely Brea Grant. This is a film, horror film, about these guys find a VHS board game, horror board game, and they decide to play it. And I was a little bit disappointed by this film, gonna be honest. The premise is so great. I mean, you're thinking like a horror Jumanji, right? Type flick. And I feel like it takes forever to kind of get anywhere near there. There is some decent gore. There's one great voodoo doll scene that I really love, and I guffawed out loud. But I didn't really like the lead actor, and I kind of felt a little stilted. I don't know.
You mean Graham Skipper?
He looks like he's freaking constipated all the time. Yeah, Graham Skipper.
Maybe he had a
I don't know.
I'm kind of with you. I'm kind of with you. I mean, I love the cast, and I love Jackson Stewart. Like, I love everything about it. Like, everything was in place. And, I mean, we've had Bree on the show. I love, you know, Matt Mercer. I love Grant Skipper. But, man.
I'm the asshole.
No. I wasn't a fan of it either. It's just, like, I was really, like, that was one of my most anticipated movies. Because, I mean, the VHS board game thing was so short-lived, and I think I had Nightmare. I didn't have any of the other VHS board games. So, I mean, it was a really cool concept, and it really did fall flat for me. I mean, but it doesn't suck. It's just very uneventful, I think.
Yeah. It was, a lot of people are loving it. I mean,
Stephen
Scarlatta, am I pronouncing that right? We talk a lot on back and forth on Twitter and stuff. I mean, he's, you know, I like him. I like everyone involved. Like, genuinely.
I know. Yeah.
And,
that's what I'm
just
saying.
Just a little flat for me.
Yeah. But, no, I'm the same way. I wasn't super on board with it, but the general consensus is people are digging it. It's on Netflix. Yeah. People are liking it. You know, that's what matters. I mean, tell us what you think.
Yeah, if you're curious, check it out. I think it's worth checking out if you're curious about it.
Fucking Barbara Crampton's in it. Of course it's worth it.
Yeah.
Drew was about to talk.
Oh, shit. Wow. Drew, what's up? Oh, you got to click the raise your hand button.
Oh, boop. My God.
See?
Hey!
You guys have buttons? I'm sorry.
I never even use it, so.
You want me to
we just all talk over each other.
You want me to put my 10-year-old son on for a little while? He's probably better at that. Raise your hand. I was just going to say that I saw Beyond the Gates. I actually kind of dug it. I love everyone that's involved in it. I definitely think it's worth watching. But what I was going to say is when you picture a horror Jumanji, I think it's impossible to live up to that.
Yeah, probably.
And that's how I think a lot of us went into it. And so I don't know how, especially an indie film, you know, lower-budgeted indie film could ever live up to the horror Jumanji that's in my head as soon as I read the description of it.
Right, right. I think this is a movie you need to make. Yeah.
Yeah, I have $150. So it definitely won't live up to it, but I'll make it anyways. I don't care.
I think this is one of those films that if I give it some distance and revisit it in a couple of years, I'll probably have a better opinion of it. I think, you know, a lot of the times, especially in the horror community, expectation, kind of ruins films for people, I think. And, it's one of those things I've tried to train myself from doing. Having too high of expectations for things. And, so that's why, like, you know, that's why I would never like trash it. Like, it's well made. It does what it sets out to do. For me, it just didn't hit the notes I guess I was expecting, but I would never tell anyone not to check it out or trash it because I think if you find it interesting, if you like, and if you're a Barbara Crampton fan, you're a fan of everyone, give it a shot. You might love it.
Well, we don't trash things aside from Deepwater Horizon.
Right.
And Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, Da Vinci Code.
And speaking of trashing things and speaking of Matt Damon, I checked out the film
The
Great
Team
Wall.
Is that a Team America reference?
Yeah.
You're watching big blockbuster movies. What the fuck are you doing?
It's directed by Yamao Zhang, who directed the film Hero and, what's the other film?
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I don't know.
No, he didn't do Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
I don't know.
But, hold on, I'm looking it up. House of Flying Daggers and Curse of the Golden Flower. So he's a favorite Japanese director of mine. I love all these films, all his Japanese films. Curse of the Golden Flower is is fucking gorgeous. House of Flying Daggers is a lot of fun, and Hero is pretty damn good. So he did this film called The Great Wall, which he teamed up with
Matt Damon,
some American writers, and Matt Damon to kind of do this film that takes place on the Great Wall, and they basically they're defending China from monsters. And Matt Damon is a European who ends up there. He's with some dude from Game of Thrones, and Willem Dafoe shows up in it.
Oh, man. But, that movie sounds like a... I remember seeing the trailer now.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
It's, okay. It's one of those Sunday afternoon films. If it's on cable, you might not turn it off.
I have better films to watch.
I feel, well, you know me, man. I love Japanese films, and especially I love this director, and I love monsters.
I wouldn't even consider this a fucking Japanese film.
So I was gonna check it out.
This is fucking American-made bullshit.
No. This director's influence is there in spades when there's a lot of battle sequences. There's some really creative things. Like, I feel like if they would have left the American, because this is a joint American and Chinese venture. If it was a, or is it, he's, I've been saying Japanese. It's a Chinese, he's a Chinese director. I apologize.
Oof, oh man.
Damn, yeah. Jesus. My bad.
Hey guys, we should start the whole thing over.
Hey, at least I caught myself and didn't, in editing, I would have found this. I would have been like, God damn it. And I would have felt awful. Anyway. I feel like if this was strictly a Chinese production, it would have done better because I feel like the European element kind of shoved in just doesn't feel right. And having Matt Damon's trying some sort of accent. I don't know if it's like Scottish or he's trying something, but they kind of, their scenes kind of drag everything to the halt. The monster stuff is fun. The battle stuff is fun. They do like a color coded army. It's really cool, really creative. So, anyway, if this is ever, you want to check something out, be a little bit different, I would check it out. I had fun with it, but I can see the criticisms of it. But like I said, the Chinese element of it, the design is pretty cool. But that's all I got.
I feel like I never even heard of that movie.
Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for it, but then
it's better than the trailers make it out to be.
No one fucking talked about it
until now.
It's me carrying the torch.
Someone has actually seen this movie.
Yeah, I dug a lot of it, but you know me, I like the big budget action spectacle stuff, the fantasy stuff. I mean, it's nothing. I don't know. If you think you'd like it, you'll probably have fun with it. You know who you are.
Who?
If you feel like you're going to hate it, don't even bother.
All right, I will not bother. Because, what's on my doorstep, I watched that. I texted you and I said you'd be proud of me. And I watched that fucking Cowboys and Aliens. Budget,
flops.
Or whatever it was. What's it called?
This is like Cowboys and Aliens, but with a Chinese army and a ragtag squad of
aliens.
European...
Or Cowboys and Aliens?
It's Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah, that movie sucks. moving along. Dude, like, oh my God, that movie sucks.
I knew you'd hate
bad.
It. As soon as you said you were watching it, I was like, yeah, Brad's gonna hate this fucking thing.
All right. first up. I watched a motorcycle gang movie called All Hell Breaks Loose, directed by Jeremy Garner, not Gardner from The Battery, but Jeremy Garner. It was written by The Vocabularist, which is apparently J.C. Morris, which I found out. It is basically a motorcycle gang from hell. Who comes out of hell and starts killing people. And it's a gang called Satan Sinners. The film is set up kind of like a, throwback biker film, with digital cigarette burns and wears and tears on the print, which I do enjoy sometimes, but when it's too digital, it doesn't look that great. Sometimes films pull it off, sometimes they don't, and speaking of throwbacks, I mean, we do have Drew Marvick on the show, which we will get into the kind of throwback, idea of Pool Party Massacre, but it's getting to the point where it has to be like, for example, you mentioned Beyond the Gates. Beyond the Gates does it kind of perfectly. It flows with the film. It flows with what you're watching. It doesn't really take you out of it. All Hell Breaks Loose, there's a couple moments where it's like, you know, where there's like a CG effect or something like that. And you can just kind of tell it's digital, but you're still seeing the cigarette burns and shit like that. I don't know. You have to be careful with what you, you know, when you utilize that. I think it's to be aware that what you're doing, just not like, oh, let's throw some grain on it, make it look old. You know, that's not kind of what it's for. It's, you know, it's a certain aesthetic. You want, you know, you want your film to be in that mindset. And All Hell Breaks Loose, for the most part, is like that. It's very, very funny. It's very bloody. It has a great cast. There's somebody from, I guess, Jackass in it. I don't know who that was, but they advertised that. If it's not Johnny Knoxville, I don't know who the fuck anybody is on that show. Not all that bad.
Steve-O?
I know who that is, but that's not it.
It was Danger Aaron.
Oh.
Yeah, I have no idea who that is on the show. I mean, I have seen Jackass. I'm not saying I haven't watched the show, but honestly, I don't really remember anybody other than, you know, I forgot Steve-O, but Johnny Knoxville, mainly because he's the only one that went on to really do anything afterwards, it seems. It's a fun little flick, you know, kind of cool throwback. If you like, you know, that kind of extreme indie horror films that mix in comedy, gore, and action, it's definitely up there for you. It's a Wild Eye movie, by the way, I might say. So that means, Sean, you won't like it. next up was Exorcist the Fallen. It's funny that there's like this barrage of Exorcist movies that come out where it's Exorcist then a subtitle. Like, we're supposed to be trying to trick the people into believing that there's another Exorcist film. I mean, I know it's not the filmmakers. It's obviously these companies that are picking up about films about exorcism or the devil or anything of that matter and trying to spin it on a sequel basis to The Exorcist, which is fucking ridiculous. That's kind of what happened with this. It's originally called Victoria's Exorcism. Basically, it's about a girl that gets possessed. Kind of a standalone, you know, it's very standard, nothing special. Wasn't a fan of it. But what is really weird, and this is kind of just making fun of the film a little bit, is that in the film, you know, of course we have CGI fire. We have, you know, CGI water, which I understand if you have to have it rain, if you have to set a fire and you're an indie filmmaker, it's pretty tough. Like Pool Party Massacre, the entire pool is CGI. Yeah. kidding. But you know, when it's raining, you know, you have to do CGI, and you know, I get it. But there's certain things where, to me, as making movies before, the do's and do nots, and just things that are very easy to come by, this film uses, like, I understand maybe gunshots, a beheading, a head blowing up, maybe some special, you know, some touch up with, you know, CGI or whatever. But when people are just bleeding or they have blood coming out of their mouth, I don't really think there's a need for CGI. And this film constantly does it to the point where the demonic Victoria is like bent down on the floor, like eating away at somebody's guts. And it really looks like, and this is not an exaggeration, that they just shot it. And then in post, they just went to paint and then took like the red paintbrush and just kind of circled around her hands. And you can just see it moving like very, like it's just really weird. And then whenever she's looking around, they do it on her eyes as well. And I'm just like, of all the easy things to do as far as effects goes in movies, you can't do some fucking blood? Or did you not, maybe it was too dark and they just didn't see it and they wanted it brighter? I don't know. But it's just
CGI blood is like the bane of my existence. It pisses me off.
Right, but when it's super easy to apply and do, I really don't get it. Like I understand your beef, but like, you know, squibs or something like that, it's like, I really wish they would have went full throttle and, you know, Charlie's Angels 2 style and just had like, you know, blood spurting out of somebody. But like, I get it. I understand. But when it comes to just showing blood on screen, I mean, come on, guys. I made a short for fucking $20 and I had better blood than that. But anyways.
Well, in this movie's defense, if you look at the cover art, you should know.
Right. Here's the thing. I'm going to be a hypocrite because I just said no to Great Wall. But when it comes to usually horror films or independent, like I usually say no to big budget movies. But if it comes to, you know, indie films, I will hardly ever say no. Ever. So when it comes across my desk or on my doorstep, I'll watch it. It doesn't bother me. So next up, we have this. I remember watching this when I was younger. I saw it maybe when I was 13 or 14, and this film was the shit to me. And it recently came out on Blu-ray from Epoch, Cinema Epoch. They put a Blu-ray out of it, so I was really happy that they did that. But I picked up Private Lessons on Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't believe that this movie was actually made. I mean, the plot of this film is that there is a widowed man with a son who is 15 years old. And the new housekeeper and the driver plan to embezzle money. So they have this older lady, an adult, seduce this 15-year-old boy. When I was 13 or 14, I thought this shit was hot shit because I wanted this shit to happen to me. But as an adult now, 32 years old, watching this film was very awkward. I mean, we're not just talking about some, you know, like kiss on the cheeks, you know, pat on the back, wearing seductive clothing. We're talking about total fucking bang jobs. I mean, we're talking about...
How does this compare to My Tutor?
It's not even close, man. My Tutor's great.
Okay.
But this is... You know, I mean, we have a kid watching the girl undress, then we have him banging her down twice, grabbing her little titties. I mean, we have a bath sequence where she's like rubbing his chest and like jerking him off.
How's this different from My Tutor? Because My Tutor is the same thing where a 29-year-old tutor basically bangs her 15 or 16-year-old.
Is he 16?
Well, he's a high school senior, so maybe he's 17. Okay.
Here's a couple differences in My Tutor, I guess. And okay. This isn't like me saying, okay, that one's fine. But this kid is 15 in the film, but he looks 12. He looks very, very young. He does not look 15. So that does play a bigger part in the movie, because you can say somebody is 15, but then you can, you know, cast an adult, and it's not as bad. But when you cast a kid as a little kid, and he looks even younger than he actually supposed to be, then it gets a little weird. But my point
is... Who's the kid?
Like,
is that Matthew Modine?
No, dude. No, this Matthew dude Medine's is right? Eric Brown. No. Matthew Modine. It's Ed Begley Jr.'s in it. But so my thing is like it's very awkward to watch as an adult.
I clicked on private school, not private lessons.
Oh Jesus Christ! This is why Wikipedia does not work. So the film was very controversial at the time. It actually did quite well at the box office. But man, here's the thing though. And this is my main issue with it, and I'm not mean to get, like, all PC, but just switch the gender roles for a minute. This movie would have never been written.
Dude, so it's okay, bro.
Right. And, I mean, I have a feeling, like, you know, kids watching this back in the day, what did they grow up thinking? They're just going to bang, it's easy to bang an older lady and... Like, I mean, just switch the gender roles for a second. Have a 20, I think she's like 29 or something, in the bath. I mean, watch fucking Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane and look how awkward that is, or something like Lolita, that even just the sexual advances towards the younger girls is uncomfortable. But imagine full-fledged touching and, you know, getting down and dirty and boning.
Total bang Jesus. Jobs, as you said.
Yeah, they're bang like, jobs. Total I mean, he's, bang jobs. This guy is getting two total bang jobs. Other than that, the transfer is decent. It's got a great, 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 great soundtrack. It's meant to be kind of a dark comedy. It does have some funny moments. John DeBont shot it, which is kind of odd. but hey... Whatever. But yeah, not all that bad. But definitely, very awkward to watch, but I suggest it because there's not too many films like this. That's for sure. And then, Bad Santa 2. That movie fucking blew cock. That's all I gotta say. the thing is, and the reason why I watched it is because I'm not against the original Bad Santa film. I found it somewhat enjoyable and very offensive and funny. here's a sequel that no one fucking asked for 15 years later. Who knows exactly why they made this movie? Just because they found out that Billy Bob Thornton is a real asshole in real life. So he's just playing Billy Bob Thornton. But yeah, movie sucks, man. And then, so Deepwater Horizon and Bad Santa 2, those are on my shit list. I know that we talked about CoverGirl on the last episode of 1940s, Rita Hayworth and Gene Kelly, but I got around to watching Young Girls of Rochefort.
Do I need to create, like, an intro to segment on Brad Watches... musicals.
I got it bad. To reiterate,
this is a horror podcast.
You talked about Great Wall and Ally. so I guess that's more horror than Young Girls of Rochefort, though. to reiterate my history of musicals, I stayed away from them. I watched maybe a couple here, like sporadically, like the film sporadically, like scenes. And I just was totally turned off by it. My mom was obsessed, like, with stage play musicals like Cats and, you know, Phantom of the Opera and stuff like that. And I went to go see those, and I fucking hated them. So, and I saw those when I was younger. So I thought, and it kind of like Wizard of Oz too, I was thinking that those films would always be like that, like a stage play. Like, fucking Wizard of Oz looks fucking terrible. It looks like a fucking stage play. And it is, kind of. So I just completely abandoned that altogether in my life. I watched every single genre, any movie I could get my hands on, but I just steered away from musicals hard. And then I watched CoverGirl, and... I was like, wait a second, Gene Kelly's like really like awesome and Rita Hayworth is super sexy. So let me see what's going on. So Criterion put out Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which I haven't watched yet, and they also put out Young Girls of Rochefort. So I popped in Jacques Demy, his film, Young Girls of Rochefort. And I tell you what, man, this movie just fucking melted me right in my seat. It's super cute. It's funny. It's got a great soundtrack. Gene Kelly is absolutely amazing. Yes, and he's pretty much the only American that pops up in this French film. But it's just he's so charming in his films, and his dance sequences are, you know, like above everybody else's. And the one cool thing about this film for the horror people is that there's this really, really weird subplot of a serial killer in the film. And it's weird because they introduce all these characters. I mean, Catherine, I'm really bad at pronouncing French names, so any of the French people listen to this podcast or speak French or know how to pronounce these names, fucking forgive me. But Catherine Deneuve, or Dina Yuve, maybe? And I sound like fucking Sean right now. Jesus Christ. And her, the girl that plays her sister, her name's Solange in the film, Francoise Dorliac, which actually died tragically, like right after this movie was made. She was only like 29 or something, died in a car accident. But these two, basically, they're twins, and they have ballet classes, and they kind of just want to fall in love, and it's about them trying to get themselves out there and fall in love with, you know, whoever comes by. Spoiler alert, one of them's Gene Kelly, which I fell in love with Gene Kelly as soon as I saw him in the movie too. But back on track of the serial killer, there's this weird thing where they're just like, they break in, they're like, they talk about this crime scene that they saw and about how there is blood everywhere. And then they go into detail, and one of the songs is called Cut Her Up in Little Pieces. And they sing about how this serial killer basically chopped up this woman. And I'm like, what the fuck is happening? And there's this, and they talk about the serial killer throughout the film. And then it's revealed. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of bizarre. Like, I mean, this truly is kind of falling in love story, really cute and, you know, dancey dance. And then we just have a fucking serial killer subplot. So if you're into horror, it's not a horror film at all, but it does have
there
something
is a song
for you
about cutting people into pieces. What's this musical called?
It's called The Young Girls of Rochefort. So yeah, it's like I said, it's very cute. And I'm really, really excited to dive into some of this director's other work, as you know, his non-musicals as well as his other musicals. And just I mean, it's fabulous. So, and that's pretty much it.
Is it in English?
No. It's Gene Kelly. Actually, I looked it up. Gene Kelly speaks French, Latin, Yiddish, and, English, obviously.
Damn.
But yeah, cause I was watching it and then it didn't feel like his lines were dubbed. And I was like, what the fuck? Gene Kelly speaks French? What? And he does. Yeah. And, yeah, it's entirely in French, of course, but it's, and another thing about the film on a technical level, I mean, the sets are fucking spectacular. The camera work is out of this fucking world. I mean, the tracking shots that they have in the film that captures the city, and it's the costumes are, you know, just very, very pretty. They're very vibrant with kind of what the summer is showing. I mean, it's a summertime movie, so, you know, very summery colors and stuff like that. But just, it's just beautiful to look at. You can put the shit on mute and still be entertained. But yeah, in just editing and camera work, cinematography are just fucking outstanding. So there's more than just being a cute musical. Because when I'm watching these musicals, when I'm diving into this stuff, because now I'm obsessed, is that I still want well-made movies. I mean, you might have a cute song here and there. That's fine. But, you know, I want something that's also pretty to look at. I'm still watching it as a film. And that's the reason why I didn't like Grease the other night. So,
oh,
but we won't get in that until BJ's on the show.
Yeah. All right, here we go. Very cool. Let's jump into our new segment with Josh Obershaw, then we will be back talking Pool Party Massacre with Drew Marvick. Josh Obershaw joins us now to give us this week's release news. What's up, man?
Hey, Sean, and hello to everybody out there.
What's up? What's up?
Been going. Well, just kind of wishing that I was wearing my old Soundgarden Super Unknown t-shirt from high school right now.
Yeah, man. Yeah. You and pretty much probably everyone listening. Yep. Sad news about Chris Cornell for sure.
Yeah, so I've just been listening to Soundgarden all morning and still going, I might add. I guess MTV Classic is still playing all the old Soundgarden and Chris Cornell videos.
Oh, nice. Good. It's a good tribute to him for sure. Yeah.
Right.
He's a favorite. Well,
yeah, mine too. Let's talk about some happy stuff, shall we?
Yes. Okay. Or unhappy, because our wallets will be crying huge tears as we abuse them.
Well, here's a little bit of ease on the whole wallet thing. Our sponsor, Vinegar Syndrome, is holding a halfway to Black Friday sale. And the dates for that are going to be May 26th through the 29th. So that's going to be the Memorial Day weekend. They've got two limited edition Blu-rays that they're going to be announcing. There's also going to be a huge sale, 50% off everything on their site. They've got some brand new merch, a, quote, much-requested DVD collection of sorts. So, yeah, keep your eye out for that, because I'm very, very curious to find out what those limited edition Blu-rays are. They've been teasing it on Instagram, and I'm just sitting here like, damn it, tell me what it is. And let's see, next up, the big one is Arrow. Arrow just announced their August slate. Now, there's going to be two UK-only releases. They're going to be releasing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 and 1981's Shock Treatment, which is kind of sort of a sequel to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And it's I know Richard O'Brien is a big part of that. The characters of Brad and Janet are in it. I've only seen part of it, but I'd be very curious to finally revisit that one completely. There's no US-only title for the month of August, but they've got some pretty cool titles that are going to be available on both sides of the Atlantic, and the one that I'm really excited about is Lucio Fulci's Don't Torture a Duckling.
Yeah.
Now, this one is going to be packed. There weren't a lot of special features on the DVD that Blue Underground put out, but we have got, let's see here. Oh, yeah, a new audio commentary by Troy Holworth, the author of So Deadly, So Perverse, 50 Years of Italian Giallo Films, The Blood of Innocence, a new video discussion, Hell is Already in Us, a new video essay, interviews with co-writer-director Lucio Fulci, actor Florinda Bulkin, the cinematographer, the assistant editor. I mean, this thing is definitely going to be worth the upgrade. Another one, this is an interesting one, John Frankenheimer's Ronin from 1995, I believe. It's with Robert De Niro and Jean Reno.
Awesome. What else do we... Solid action flick, man. I'm excited to see it get a cool treatment for sure.
Yeah, this is one that my brother speaks very, very highly of, and I can't believe I missed out on this one. That one's going to be coming out on August 14th in the UK and 15th in the US. Same thing with Don't Torture a Duckling. They've also got Eric the Conqueror coming out. But here is one. I have never heard of this movie, but when Arrow announced it, my Twitter feed just went off the hook. And that is 1982's The Slayer.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been one of those elusive, I think, stuck on VHS titles that a ton of people have been asking for.
I see. There's going to be a 4K scan of the original negative. Awesome. Uncompressed mono audio, excuse me. New interviews with the cast and crew. So this is definitely going to be definitely one to pick up. I mean, judging by the artwork, I think this is going to be a blind buy for me. I'm very curious to find out what this is all about. Especially since it looks like a monster movie that came out right smack in the middle of the first wave of slashers.
Yeah, I what I've read, and I haven't read too much on it, I think it seems like some hybrid between slasher and monster movie. So I'm in. That's all you need to tell me.
Totally. So that is your August slate from Arrow Video. Those are some of the big headlines for this week. I got a couple of little things to share with you. Those that have been waiting for Shin Godzilla to come to the United States on home video, that is going to be August 1st, courtesy of Fun Animation. No special features to really write home about, but yeah, I'm very, very curious about this one. But yeah. It's Toho Godzilla. I mean, if you've seen one Toho Godzilla movie, you've seen them all. But still, it's new Toho Godzilla.
Totally. Come on. I'm totally pumped. Googly eyes and all, bring it on.
And next up from 88 Films, they've got three titles coming out later this year. They've got The House on Sorority Row, which, of course, Scorpion has already put out. And two more Code Red titles. We've got Slaughterhouse Rock and Sweet 16.
So are they adding those to buy? Because those have been out, Slaughterhouse Rock and Sweet 16.
Yeah, over here in the U.S., Code Red, it got those
titles. Oh, sorry. I'm totally spacing out. My bad. Apologies, everybody. It's 88 good, Films and Code Red, man. They're releasing the same movies, and it gets confusing. Awesome. Good stuff. Right. Sorry to derail the entire news segment altogether.
Let's see. What else have I got? Oh, yeah. This is not necessarily horror, but I know a lot of people are excited about this one. Bobcat Goldthwait's 1991 film, Shakes the Clown. That one is coming out on July 11th. That's the good news. The bad news is it's Mill Creek. So don't expect any bonus features. But if you just want the movie on Blu-ray, it's going to be at a decent price.
It'll be like $7 or $8, man. You can't go wrong.
Exactly. And one other thing I want to point out to everybody. Last year we told you about, Jim Warnowski's The Return of Swamp Thing.
Mm-hmm.
That is currently out on Blu-ray as of May 15th. So if you have a region-free player, it's available on Blu-ray right now.
Oh,
I don't know what the special features are. I've been looking for them, but
oh my god,
yeah.
I know what I'm doing right after this. I'm buying that.
Nice. That's a fun one for sure. I love that movie, and it's got one of my favorite opening credit sequences with, you know, CCR's Born on the Bayou playing, and
that's so good.
So good. So that's all the news I got for you, Sean.
All right, Josh. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you next time.
See you guys later. Peace.
The main focus today is this flick that Brad told me to watch and Brad told me to pay my hard-earned money for.
Yeah, he did.
It's a film called Pool Party Massacre. Let's murder! Let's murder!
Blair Winthorpe and her friends don't know it yet, but they are about to have the worst pool party ever. Pool Party Massacre, coming soon.
Drew, where the fuck did you come from, man?
Well, I was invited.
Yeah. I have a
good preface to this story, actually.
Yes, Brad, please.
So, a good lead up to intro for Drew. So, months and months ago, just scrolling through Twitter, I stumbled across a poster of what was Pool Party Massacre, and my immediate thought was this is just a, you know, kind of a little, not a spoof movie, but just a fake poster that somebody made up, like, hey, look at this movie that could have existed. I mean, they're around everywhere. And it wasn't tagged with anything, it just said Pool Party Massacre, and I just didn't hit the search engine to look it up because I've stumbled across those before. They're just cool looking posters that exist and nothing else. And kind of forgot about it. And then I went to Spooky Empire in April and I was walking around and I saw this big banner. It was Pool Party Massacre. And I was like, holy shit, I know what that is. And I was like, wait, this is a real fucking movie. Like, this is crazy. And, it was a booth just selling that. There was no other merchandise at the table but DVDs, Blu-rays, posters, stickers, and action figures, head sold separately. And behind the counter was Brian Mills, the editor of the film, and Drew. And I introduced myself, and we had a brief chat, and I think I told Drew kind of the story of me stumbling across the poster months ago, and I had no idea it was a real film. And you know, just, you know, Blu-ray was $20, no big deal, dropping $20 just to support the, you know, indie machine. And then we just talked away for talked for a couple minutes, and I walked away. And then I sat down because I was with my daughter at the time, and she wanted to get, you know, a quick bite to eat and something to drink. So we're sitting in the lobby, and, you know, she's playing on her phone or whatever, and I was just, I just started looking at the Blu-ray, and I cracked it open, and I was like, it's a fucking press disc? Like, who the fuck is this guy? And, I mean, for people that collect, you know what a press disc is, you know what a fucking BDR is. So I was like, man, this is really fucking cool. So, you know, of course, at Spooky Empire, you just don't walk around once. You walk around 30 times. And, you know, I was walking around again in that area, and I just decided to stop back and just kind of chat. It was, you know, no one was at the booth at the time. I mean, other than that, that booth was fucking crowded with babes. But at this point, no one was there.
Total bang jobs.
Total bang jobs. And then Drew and I talked some more, and that's kind of how this all came to be, which was really cool. And it was really funny because when I'm out, I, you know, and at these things, I don't like say, oh, I'm Brad from the Screamcast. I just mention, you know, I had, you know, on our show, whatever.
You weren't wearing your shirt?
No.
You're carrying around like a speaker playing our show.
No. I don't ever broadcast it like that because I it's just something I don't do. And then, you know, Drew did ask. He's like, "What is your show?" And I told him, and then he was just like, "Can I be on it?" And I was like, "Well, I mean, you just kind of, you know, watch the movie first, or, you know, just not just jumping into it." And then Drew asked, he's like, "Do you have people with shitty movies on your show?" And I said, "Sometimes." He goes, "Well, why can't I be on your show?" And I was like, all right, this guy is wins already because I don't have anything to say. I don't have anything to counter this. So then it was kind of born from there. And I fell in love with Drew and his charming personality and that very awesome beard. So that's about it.
That's a beautiful
story. Did it get weird? So my question for you is start from the fucking beginning, other than being inspired by, obviously, 80s slasher films and horror films.
Yeah, so don't talk about that part.
Well, we'll get into that later.
You mean the beginning of, like, how did this movie come about?
When did your dad's penis go into your mom's vagina?
And well, I mean, just when just who were you are, after that? Where you know, what decided to make something like a 80s throwback slasher film? Obviously, I mean, I know the answer, but tell our audience here.
Sure. Well, I mean, I feel like I always wanted to make an 80s slasher film as far as I can remember. Like even back in high school when that's all I watched, but I didn't know it was possible. It's funny. I grew up in Orange County, California, which is, I don't know, maybe an hour away from Hollywood. But for some reason, I thought I lived too far away from Hollywood to ever work in movies, which makes sense for people that live in other places of the country. But for someone who has to drive through Hollywood to get to the airport, it was probably idiotic. But so I didn't think it was realistic until later in life. I found myself I work in production. I actually make a living in production, not by making movies like Pool Party Massacre, because that costs me money, but by producing commercials. And so being on set all the time, I just always talk about, I try to convince everyone I work with to make a horror movie with me, because everyone I work with is much more talented than I am and has a particular skill. So I pretty much have, for 10 years, have just been trying to convince people to lend me their talents so I could make a bad movie. And finally I convinced Brian Mills.
Yeah.
And that's how Pool Party Massacre was born.
Now, how much influence and how much impact did Brian have in the project? And, you know, was the idea there previously, or did it just like, hey, let's make a slasher, and we did it?
I mean, so the story goes, Brian called me one day to tell me that he got a new camera package and was looking for something to shoot with it. He was excited about it. And as a commercial producer, I think he wanted me to know so that I could rent his camera package from him. But that's not how my brain works. I instantly just thought, hey, maybe we could make a movie with this. And he actually volunteered that information. He said, man, I wish somebody had a script. I got this new camera. I have the next 2 months off. I would love to shoot something for free. And so a little spark went off in my head. And I said, well, I have a script. And he said, you do? Is it ready to shoot? And I said, yeah, of course. It's totally ready. He asked what it was. I said, it's a slasher movie. And the first thing that popped in my head was Pool Party Massacre for some reason. So I blurted out, it's called Pool Party Massacre. I kind of came up with the plot on the fly. I mean, the basic, you know, I said it's about a bunch of girls at a pool and a killer's killing them off. I mean, that's probably pretty obvious by the title. And he totally bought my story and said, all right, cool. Well, then send over the script and we'll start pre-production. And I said, oh, you know, I'm sure a lot of writers have done this. And I said, oh, well, let me just polish it up. I haven't looked at it in a while. I've been working on some other scripts. And give me a week. And then I went and locked myself in my office and actually wrote the script and sent it over to him. And for some reason, he liked it. And that's when we actually started the process. So it wasn't, I mean, the idea of it, other than, you know, ripping off Slumber Party Massacre, wasn't really there until that phone conversation.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really, really fun flick. Like I bought it, and then it arrived, and of course I had to get the autographed edition.
Well, we need to go back to basically I told Sean what was happening. I was like, hey man, went to Spooky Empire. A couple people knew me, very, very weird. You know, people came up to me. And I was like, hey, man, I bought this film. And I, like, took a picture of it. And I basically, the Blu-ray. And Sean's, like, first reaction was like, oh, my God. Like, in the sense of, like, Sean saying, you got to be fucking kidding me. I'm not watching that. I knew it. I was like, dude, I was like, trust me. I haven't even watched the movie yet. But buy it. And you know, let's just see where it goes.
As soon as you told me that, like, look, even if this movie's shitty, Drew still's gonna come on the show. Like, he still wants to come on the show. I sold you on this guy.
I mean, I won you over just by saying, hey, also, this motherfucker pressed his own disc for some reason, and he's just like self distributing, basically, like. I don't know who the fuck this guy is, but like, this is really kind of cool in an indie world, because we have these big companies that have money that aren't doing this. And some of them were only doing DVD only. So I said, you know, this is definitely something just to look at in general. And then I watched the film and then you watched the film and we were like, oh shit, like this is fucking cool as shit. You know, bang yeah. jobs.
Well, I mean,
total bang jobs.
Yeah. It's a bang, total bang job of a flick. Well, no, because I mean, I got it and I had seen people posting those, the action figures on Twitter and stuff. And I was like, the marketing, you know, the marketing, right? Like the poster and then these action figures. I was like, it's fucking genius. And I was like, I really, really, really hope this movie's decent. Like, I hope I have fun with this is all I'm wondering. Cause, you know, you see as in indie horror movies, like for me, I mean, I got three kids. I don't got time to waste. Like for some reason, Brad has all the time in the world to watch these shitty movies. I don't know.
I just make them.
I just don't feed the kids or take care of her.
Okay, yeah. But it's hard. You know, I'm always worried when it comes to, like, an indie horror movie that I haven't heard of. You know, I'm always like, oh, my God. Like, all right, you know. I'm going to have my phone ready just in case I get bored. I'm going to start tweeting and bullshitting while this movie's play.
Oh, boy. Oh, God.
But, no, I mean, we've been doing this show for fucking 3 years. We've watched a lot of shitty movies you know, we're like, hey, what can we cover? Let's watch this. Nope, it was garbage. Let's move on, you know?
Yeah. No, but as soon as the movie started and you have the pool guy who's tatted up, listening to metal, he's cleaning the pool, and then with the bored rich housewife, the interchange between the two was like so, I don't know, man. It just made me laugh. It was so, like, witty in a sense, you know? The metal had me too. I was like, fuck, this guy's also obviously in the metal. And I you know, put my phone down, nestled
into
my
phone. He had his phone in his hands.
I did. You never
he
know.
Was ready.
Some of this shit. Put the phone down, you know, my dog is next to me. She got comfortable. I got comfortable. Had a couple drinks at the ready and had a hell of a time watching this, man. This is a really fun flick. Like, the script is punchy. Like, the dialogue is punchy. The gore scenes are great. I mean, this is, like, almost like something that could have been shot back in the 80s and something that we, as fans, would love. But I love the fact that it was a modern flick. Like, this takes place now, you know, but it's just happens to be in the style of kind of an 80s slasher with a few references here and there. But it was... Man, I just had a really fun time watching this, and as soon as I got done watching it, I was just like, I need to tell as many people as possible to give this movie a shot, because you don't run across too many indie flicks like this that know the subject matter and are having fun with it, but they're not, I don't know, they're not being lazy about it. They're not.
Well, I mean, I think it also
goes
for
the easy references.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to, and this isn't anything negative. This is, you know, you obviously know what your movie was. You knew what it wanted to be, and it wasn't anything more than that. And I think what happens with a lot of these types of films, and just films in general, is that people have kind of that Troy Duffy syndrome where they think they're the king shit, they have the best movie out there, and they just really don't know what to do, or, you know, they just automatically expect people to like it because they're making a revolutionary cinema or something like that. And, I mean, I think that this goes hand in hand with kind of what these films from the 80s were all about. And when we watch them with friends, we watch them with our, our good buddies or horror friends. We talk amongst them about ourselves. We have fun with the corniness of the film. We have fun with the one-liners. We have fun with the characters. And we have a fun time. And that's what it's all about. And you can feel that. It's almost like shot on video films. That's the reason why I always stand behind them, is because those movies, they're not making them to be millionaires. They know they're not going to make a big break in Hollywood. They're making a film with their friends to hang out with their friends and just have a fucking good time. And that's exactly what Pool Party Massacre feels like. You know, it's not going to be this huge break into, you know, the horror industry. It's there. It knows what it is and it has fun with it. And I think that's what I appreciate about it. And I mean, whether you're trying to achieve that or not, Drew, I don't know, but that's definitely what it seems like and how it feels. And I think that's the reason why people, like this more than, I mean, because the barrage of fucking indie slashers and indie films we have is overwhelming. And we watch that shit all, I watch that shit all day long. And most of the time I'm like, eh, whatever. But it's very rare for me to be like, oh man, this is a good time. This reminds me of growing up. And that's kind of what this film did. So that was me sucking your dick and you can talk now.
Man, dicks have been sucked.
Oh, it's been a while.
Balls
Thank
have
you.
Been caught.
I'm surprised that I was able to pull it off, but that, according to you, I did. But that's exactly what I was going for. I just wanted to make a fun slasher movie that had the spirit of an 80s slasher. I looked at it as if I could take my 15-year-old self and bring him to present time and let him write and direct a slasher film, what would it be? And that's kind of what I did.
So what did you do? Because you had to round up actors and things like that. I mean, what was your timeline like as far as getting one together? Was it, did you have to go through a casting process or did you just try to grab as many people who were willing to jump in on this? I know that your wife's in it.
She is, reluctantly. we ended up going through a casting process, but originally once I had the script written, Brian had a short window of time that he was actually moving to Florida. So he had cleared his schedule for the next, I think it was 2 months. So he said, hey, if you can pull this off in the next 2 months, I'll shoot and edit it for you. And so my plan at that point, for some dumb reason, I wanted to make the movie for $11. I don't know where the number came from, but I thought to myself, if I can make this movie for $11, like that, people will remember that. It's the $11 slasher. Like, we got to. And so I'm sure I was drinking. But so I went into it with that mentality. I gave him the script. I said, Brian, I'm going to get a bunch of my friends. I'll get my wife. You know, my kids can put a wig on my son, whatever I have to do. And we're making this movie and we're doing it before you leave. You know, print. And he said, okay, I'll print some scripts and I'll come over. And then he came over to my house to go over them. And when he got there, he handed me the receipt for printing the scripts at the FedEx and it was $73. Oh shit. Well, scratch the $11 movie. So, and right around that point, his timetable changed and he suddenly had more time. So we started taking it a little more serious and decided to cast the movie, have some auditions. I then, did some rewrites, made some things hopefully better. And so yeah, we did. We had local auditions and it ended up taking a lot longer than we expected. All of this was taking place in July and we didn't even end up start. First day of shooting wasn't until the day after Thanksgiving in November.
Damn.
So we ended up taking months to actually cast it properly. I mean, the deeper into pre-production I got, the more excited I got. And suddenly,
yeah,
I was so excited to make a movie period, but I also then realized I kind of wanted try to make a good movie.
Well, I mean, yeah, you have this as a filmmaker, you have this nice time frame. You have this, if you have the equipment and you have, people willing to make a movie, yeah, it's like, all right, let's do it. Then it's like, wait a second, let's hold up because I actually, this is real now and I want to make something that is at least, I don't want this to be just on my computer and show it to friends when they're over. You know, I want to be able to put this out there into the world and for people to see it. So, yeah.
Exactly.
I totally get that.
It started to become a real movie. And originally it was kind of just for me. I treated it as me getting my first feature out of the way. And it didn't matter if what it was or if anyone saw it. I just needed to, pop that cherry, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But then, every time I showed the script to someone and they actually liked it, I started to see potential and say, oh, you know, maybe there's a real movie here.
How did you get Alexis Adams?
I kind of lucked out with Alexis Adams. My makeup artist, Katie Jacobs, who's a good personal friend of mine, knows her personally and had done her makeup before. And when I mentioned to her that I was looking for someone for that role in particular, I said, I want somebody that's comfortable with nudity and maybe implied a little bit of implied sex, but not, you know, I need somebody that fits, but you know, and I wanted them to have great tits. That was kind of also a qualification. And she mentioned Alexis. And when I Googled her, her tits popped up immediately.
Note to self, clear my browser history right now.
Yes. And, and it worked out. She wants to do more, I don't know, I guess you call them straight films. So she was excited for the opportunity to be in a feature film. And I was excited for the opportunity to have her in it. So it just kind of worked out. I lucked out, I guess.
Now,
she lives here in Vegas.
Oh, that's cool.
That helped.
Now, was your wife, since you said she was in it reluctantly, now was that like a last minute thing just to fill it in, or was it like, hey, we're making a movie together?
No, I mean, I always wanted her to be a part of it. I throw her in. I mean, I put her in stuff constantly. I'm always torturing her in some way, shape, or form. So in my mind, she was always a part of it. I didn't know if she would even do it or how big of a part she would be, but I really wanted her to be a part of it. Especially, I mean, one, it's my first feature film, and two, it was a very much a family affair.
I mean,
everyone in my family had to be involved. We didn't have, I mean, the money was just coming from my savings account and selling movie posters. And so I love that, the idea of that, of bringing us together. So
she has like the best gag, I think, in the flick with the hammer through the jaw. God damn it.
It's funny. That's the first kill scene that we shot because for some reason I thought it would be the easiest to pull off. So I scheduled it first and it ended up being by far the hardest and the worst. And it was a horrible decision to shoot that first. And if you watch it, luckily it fits with the film.
Yeah.
But if you really watch it, the cuts had to be so short because it was impossible to keep the handle of the hammer even with the claw part that was sticking out of her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It would just, it kept, I mean, there are some takes that were ridiculous.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can kind of see in the behind the scenes footage that, you know, that wasn't easy, especially her holding herself up and, you know. It did not look pleasant.
No, and it wasn't. And if you've ever been covered in fake blood, it dries quickly and it's very sticky and uncomfortable. So yeah, I'm sure it wasn't. Well, actually, I know it wasn't pleasant. She's told me several times.
Yeah,
that it wasn't. But
what I love about it, I mean, each kill, each gag in the film, like it. It feels like 100% on par with what would have happened in, say, like Slumber Party Massacre or a film like that. You know, everything's practical. You show what you can when you can, but even if you don't show, you know, full on like weapon penetration or anything like that, it's still very messy. You know, and I know that was a budgetary constraint of these earlier, you know, horror flicks. Was that, did you go into that as a, look, this is a budgetary constraint, or was that a deliberate, you know, idea to kind of keep these kills, you know, on par with other kind of 80s movies?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything, definitely I kept referring back. I kept trying to think, okay, what would it be? What would they have done? You know, if this was 1984, how would they have done this? But then I also had limitations in certain scenes because there were a couple where I wanted to go a little bigger, like the whole Alexis Adams, everything in that bedroom with Alexis's character and with Troy. I wanted. I think in the original script, there's blood hitting the ceiling fan, and then the ceiling fan is spraying it in a circle around the room as it's hitting the fan, which I should have known better when I was even writing it, but there was no way I could do that unless I built a set. So there was one or two instances where it was very obvious that I couldn't do what was in the script, but the rest, it was, you know, deliberate in the sense that I wanted to do it in a way that was accurate.
Nice.
Now, aside from, of course, like Slumber Party Massacre and stuff being, you know, because I feel that's just obvious inspirations.
Sure.
What else, like, kind of, definitely, it didn't even be anything horror related, just as far as like, films in general, like what was your turning point saying, you know, because it seems like you've been in production and film for some time, but when you were younger, what was that thing that triggered Pool Party Massacre? If you knew it was going to be then, because you said you always kind of wanted to do an 80s slasher, you know, so what was the turning point? What were some of the films that really stood out that inspired this film in general?
I watched, my friends and I, there were a couple tapes that we carried around with us, but most of them were in that same campy 80s horror vein, Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3, movies like that, April Fool's Day, Happy Birthday to Me. There was another movie, I don't know if you've seen it, Shock 'em Dead.
Yeah. We talked about that on the show one time.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah, we talked about it at Spooky Empire too, actually, yeah. I think. But Shock 'em Dead was a movie that my friend Bob had recorded off of like USA Up All Night onto a tape with commercials, and we would like bring it to each other's houses and watch it over and over again. And so it's movies like that really made me want it. And that's right around the time when I started taking film classes after school and wanting to try to make something like that. And then was easily discouraged and distracted and apparently forgot about it for 20 years.
My only question, just because I'm kind of a nut, and I didn't ask you this via like text or when we were talking, is there a reference to the unnameable in the film?
No.
Okay.
I
thought it was one of the names.
Oh, no.
Of the family name. So
the Winthorpe?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the main characters in the H.P. Lovecraft unnameable.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so and that's kind of a slasher. It's a monster, but it's still a, you know, considered a slasher film. Unnameable.
Happy Accident.
One and two. So, but yeah, it was just like when I watched it twice because I was, you know, watched it for the first time and then watched it again with, you know, partial commentary and just, you know, brushing up before the show. And then, you know, I was trying to think, okay, let's see, like, you know, if I, because I always like to do that with stuff like that, you know, I always had fun with Scream trying to point out all the, you know, the small little references or even horror films today, you know, names, places, you know, just the little homage-y stuff. So I was trying to catch the stuff in that other than, you know, of course, I mean, Slumber Party Massacre 2 for sure with the drill through the chest, was one of my, favorites. And I mean, Clay in general, that fucking character, I mean, he's definitely the highlight as far as character goes in the film.
Oh, he's great. That's gotta be one of the best character deaths.
Fucking suntan lotion all over his fucking chest. Like, I mean, his lines are fucking great. You know, I thought the Ferris Bueller's Fight Club talk was funny because I remember hearing about that fucking theory. And I thought it was really funny. He was explaining to somebody that really doesn't give a shit. And he doesn't even really, and he like stumbles across that. Like, he's like, oh, wait, was that it? Like, am I telling it right?
yeah.
So, and you know that, you know, when movies reference other movies, and it's, you know, in that sense, kind of like, you know, and Tarantino made that really, really popular, as well. I mean, even Scream took that to a whole new, level. It's always fun when movies recognize movies do exist. I always find that, entertaining.
Yeah.
And that, the Clay character, well, first the Winthorpe, the family name, maybe it would have been cooler if it was an nameable reference. It's actually a Trading Places reference. It was Dan Aykroyd's character's last name. And so when I was nice. Which is obviously not a horror movie, but when I was writing it, that just kept popping into my head as like an iconic, like super prick, douchey rich guy name. And that's what stuck out. But the Clay character was definitely my favorite character to write, for sure, and in the movie. It's kind of a blend of several of my friends. One of my friends who happens to actually be named Clay. most of the character is from him and my experiences, you know, going to college and growing up with him. So that was definitely my inspiration was Clay. And then the Nick Beyer, the actor who plays Clay, is a good friend of mine too, and is just hilarious in real life and a great actor. So it was written for him. No, I can't imagine anyone else doing it. So it was very specifically written for him, and then I had to convince him to do it.
Kind of having that, you know, kind of buddy mentality on the set, and you can feel that kind of ooze through the screen too. You know, is where it's, you know, kind of a, you know, like you said, a family affair. How much freedom did you give kind of your actors with something like this? Because, I mean, obviously it didn't feel, and I presume it wasn't a super serious set. So kind of how was the attitude with kind of the actors, and did anybody do their own thing, or was it just like, hey, this is the general idea? Or was it kind of more sticking to what you had written, and people did take it seriously?
Well, I mean, it definitely was a relaxed, yeah, relaxed set. I mean, it was intended to be, but I think it would be pretty hard to take it too seriously with me at the helm. I still think I have that in me, but I gave everyone the freedom to develop their characters and to kind of go with it a little bit. But I also was happy with the majority of the script the way it was. So I would always, you know, I as a rule, we kind of got it the way it was written, and then would do a couple takes for them and let them explore. And then we would, you know, when we actually had time, I would go over it and ask them, you know, to put things in their own words. And I would make some adjustments there too. I mean, I do some acting as well. And sometimes there's just certain phrases or words that don't flow naturally. And
no,
so it's
I think
never
going
to work.
Yeah. I mean, I've made four short films myself, and yeah, I write the script, but then when I have, because I mean, I live in fucking Florida, I don't have actors around me, it's mostly just friends doing me favors, and I'm like, hey, this is a general idea, fucking read it, and then they read it, and they sound like a fucking robot, and I'm like, you know what, this is the general idea, fucking spit it out eventually. You know, but
yeah,
be
exactly,
natural.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's what helps too, is it was something of this nature, Pool Party Massacre, a slasher that's, you know, an 80s slasher, with a bunch of hot ladies running around getting slashed up. I mean, yeah, there's got to be that sense of like, hey, try to make this not sound too corny, but also have fun with it. So I think that's a hard line to be on, because, you know, you don't, like, you know, things can be goofy, but you don't want them to be bad at the same time. So I think that's kind of a hard thing to teeter on when you're like, hey, let's have fun with this, but at the same time, we're trying to treat it seriously, but also deliver this line in a way where it doesn't sound like you're a robot, but also deliver it to where it could be, you know, laughable, but also serious. Because I think that would be a really, really tough as a director trying to explain that mentality other than just sitting everybody down and playing like 10 movies saying, do this, you know?
Which I did that also.
Okay.
I mean, there,
nice.
There was a, I mean, not specifically like do exactly this, but I mean, there was a lot of show and tell on set while they were going through hair and makeup. I would have movies playing and say, here, you know, this movie is one of my influences. This is a reference, or here's, you know, kind of the idea I'm going for, the tone I'm going for. And most of the time I was worried that it would scare them away. but fortunately it didn't. I mean, they all took it. I found a great cast.
They're all fantastic.
Yeah. They were great in their roles. They took it seriously. I mean, from the beginning, I couldn't pay them. So, I mean, from the beginning it was, I can't pay you, but I promise you this, I will take this seriously, whether you get that impression while we're shooting it or not. I promise I'm taking this very serious, and I will make sure it gets a release and a proper release, and I will treat it like it's a real movie. Even if no one else in the world thinks it is, I will treat it that way. And that'll be my payment to you. Like, I'm not trying to make money. I'm not that naive. I just want to make hopefully a fun slasher movie.
Yeah.
At least a couple people will enjoy, and you guys won't be embarrassed to have been in it. And so that was the goal from the beginning. Nice. And we might have pulled it off. They aren't embarrassed to be in it. So
no,
they
should be, man. Yeah, it's fucking funny, man. And that, I lost my shit during the vinegar stroke scene, when all the girls are explaining vinegar stroke. And I'd heard that in context, like men talking about it in the show The League.
Yeah, that's where I got it from.
But to have the women like talking about it and then giving their impersonations of it was just so funny, man. I don't know. Things that get me laughing.
It's funny because that scene in particular, for some reason, Margot, who plays Nancy, and she, I don't know if I should probably stay away from spoilers, because probably no one listening to this has seen the movie.
Right. Yeah. But, I'm staying away from some spoilers, especially toward the end.
Sure. Of course. The big spoilers. But Nancy, her character, Margot, who plays Nancy, that, for some reason, that shooting that scene really bothered her. And it ended up being like this hot button issue where during post, or right around the time when I would reach out to her about credits, she asked if we could remove it. She hadn't even seen the movie, but I guess it had been eating away at her for months, and she wanted us to remove it. And then, and when I told her that we couldn't, she started distancing. She actually told me not to put her in the credits at that time.
Oh, wow.
She kind of distanced herself from it and said, you know what, just, can I put a fake name? And I said, you could put anything you want. You know, you did me the favor of acting for me, but it's great. Like, you're great in the movie, and it's, that scene's hilarious. And I just couldn't convince her. And for some reason, that was the one thing out of everything else in the movie, that one scene, like, really,
the scene
really
of them making
her.
The faces.
Yeah.
The vinegar stroke faces?
Yeah, she... I don't know exactly what it was about it, but... And even with her character, I mean, she's the wholesome character, so she's almost doing it in a way. Like, it even references, like, how would you know? And she, you know, tries to play it off. So, yeah, but for whatever reason, that really, really stuck with her, and she was embarrassed. And now she isn't, thank God. And I don't think it helped. I also, then she would ask if she could see it, and I refused to let anyone in the cast see the movie until it premiered and they could see it in a theater with a group of people. I think it also scared them, though. And they felt that I wouldn't let them see it because it was so bad. But I kept trying to explain, no, I just don't want you to watch it on your phone. Like, that's, I want you to see it when it's done with a crowd of people and get the real experience. If you watch it on your phone while you're on set somewhere, I don't think it'll work. And so I think that was part of it too, because she would say, well, then can I please see it? And I say, no, you can't, you just have to trust me. And so it's funny that you bring that up, because for some reason that like mortified her, that people, her family would see her making that face. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but now in hindsight, she thinks it's funny again.
For those who don't know, Urban Dictionary explains a vinegar stroke as the pre-orgasmal point of no return for men during the sexual act, where failing to blurt your mess will result in blue balls. Here's a sentence referencing the term. I was pulling up to the vinegar strokes when she woke up and caught my sticky gift in her freshly opened eye.
Whoa.
Oh.
Jesus Christ.
We got a boner over here. Bone zone.
That was by Linton Gillespie, April 4th, 2006. I was with you until the she woke up part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
1,600 thumbs up, 690 thumbs down. I think we can find a better sentence to describe vinegar strokes.
I say you make one up, Sean.
Yeah.
Yeah, or you can just use the clip from Pool Party Massacre.
Here's another sentence. I was just getting into my vinegar strokes when the doorbell rang.
I know that feeling.
It's a little bit better.
Yeah.
It's a little bit better.
Or when someone texts you about to record a podcast.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That happens to me sometimes.
Or your kids like walking. Wait.
Whoa.
Jesus Christ.
Shit's getting dark. One other quick question. Was the daytime idea to set a film or a horror film at daytime budgetary reasons, or was it just, hey, a lot of horror films are at night, I want to do mine during the day?
That's funny. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Originally, it was budgetary. When I was going to make it for $11, and in a month, it was definitely the first thing that popped into my head was, all right, you know, we shoot the whole thing during the day, we'll have it take place in one day, and that way we don't have to worry about it, which is great budget wise shooting in daylight and exterior. But also if I was making a serious movie and had to worry about continuity, it was a stupid idea because the movie takes place in almost real time.
Yeah.
And we shot it over 6 months. So if you really pay attention, there's probably flowers blooming during conversations.
There may or may not be clouds and overcast parts sometimes.
Oh, there definitely is. I mean, it almost snowed one of the days we were shooting. It started raining and then hailing, and we put on the news and it said there was a forecast for snow.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was the whole thing. I mean, honestly, the whole thing was a shit show, but it was so much fun.
So,
oh man, I think you guys pulled it off.
Just to recap for our listeners, that they can go to, is it poolpartymassacre.com?
It is, poolpartymassacre.com.
And you can purchase posters, and you can purchase DVDs and Blu-rays. Blu-rays are pressed, and I imagine so are the DVDs, obviously, probably.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you're sold out of action figures, sadly.
We're sold out of action figures. There's some talk of doing a variant figure, like maybe another color bikini, or I don't know, because I get hate mail about being sold out. I didn't know anyone would buy one.
Hey, man, it's the little things.
It's great. It is.
So, and you get it like you can get different packages with the poster and t-shirts.
Yeah.
Blu-rays run about $20.
Yep. We have a
basically,
couple more
dear listener. Yeah, dear listener, we're telling you to buy that shit. Go to poolpartymassacre.com. And
the special features are really cool, too.
Oh, yeah. No, this is what I want to ask right here. Here we go. I mean, you're obviously a movie collector, Drew. And I would imagine, you know, having a press disc is pretty high on the priority list. I mean, it would be for me if I was a filmmaker. But, I mean, The cost is significantly more than if you would do like a BDR, I would imagine. I've looked into this a little bit, but I'm not for sure. Was it always on your mind, like, look, I need to give this a, you know, a primo release with special features on a pressed Blu-ray? Or, I mean, how did you just empty out your bank account? I mean, what's up, man?
It was always on my mind. I wanted it to be a proper, at least in my mind, a proper release. I wanted it to be a pressed Blu-ray. I wanted it to have special features, because those are the things that I look for when I'm going to throw down $20 to buy a movie. So yeah, it was really important to me. And also, I didn't know if this was the only movie I would ever get to make. So I didn't want it, you know, if it turns out to be, hopefully it isn't, but if it turns out to be that way, I didn't want it to be, you know, a half-ass attempt. I wanted it, I wanted to go down in history as the guy that made, even if it's the guy that made this shitty movie, but put a bunch of money into it to make special features and
present. Hey, I got this movie and I got a storage shed full of Blu-rays, but God damn it, I did it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it was really important to me. And then there were a couple things that reinforced it. One of them was actually with Jeremy Gardner, the Jeremy Gardner from The Battery.
Okay.
Who you referenced earlier. When they were making Tex Montana, I was a contributor to that, and there was a lot of dialogue about whether they should do pressed and how much work it was and how much it cost. And so I learned a lot from them, just kind of following their journey. Not that I know them personally at all, but following their journey. So luckily that taught me a lot about it too. And it reminded me how important it was.
Speaking of Tex Montana, one of the guys, like texted me when they had got all the artwork back from the cardboard, you know, they did like a cardboard Christian type case, and it was a Christian. Yeah. I think he texted you too, Brad, but they put the text flipped the wrong way.
Oh.
You know, when you have your Blu-rays all lined up in your case, right? They're all the text. It's basically, I think, facing left or whatever, right? Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. They had it facing right. So he was like, he was straight up like, how big of a deal is this? Like, should we eat all the money, you know, and redo it?
Yeah, I know Christian was a little perturbed about that.
Oh my God. But,
oh,
I mean, this isn't just like, oh, I'm going to press a disc. Like, there's like so much you have to think about, you know, artwork and everything. And for them, that was ridiculous. And I think I was like, well, how much does it cost to redo it? And he goes, well, it costs us X amount. And I was like, dude, whatever. Who gives a shit? You know, you're the odd disc in the bunch. Who cares? It's Tex Montana. Of course he'll be facing the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you just got to roll with it.
Small world, Christian and I have filmed 3 short films together.
Oh
really?
Yeah, yeah.
This has just turned into the Christian Stella moment of the podcast. Yeah.
Hey, that's fine with me. I'm a fan.
So, I mean, no, I think being a filmmaker and then and being able to do your own thing. I mean, Drew, like, if I ever would make a movie, this is exactly like what I would hope I could do, is offer some cool shit to go along with my film.
Oh, you would bay it up too. You'd have explosions.
Totally.
And shit.
Come on. Oh yeah, yeah. Come on. You kidding me? But the action figure, was that, I mean, where did that come from? It's so funny. Was it just something you thought would be hilarious? Or, I mean, as a gag or?
Pretty much. I mean, almost everything I did was for me. I guess maybe that's selfish. Maybe I'm a prick, but
yeah, narcissist.
I just thought, man, because I buy those action figures. I bought action figures from Dan at Death by Toys, who made it for me. Mm-hmm. And so going into it, it was always in the back of my mind, how cool would it be if there was an action figure? You know, once again, going back to, if I only make one movie, I'm going to do it right. And I'm going to treat it like it's fucking Star Wars. And so that was kind of my mentality from the beginning. So
nice.
I'm like, I'm going to make action figures. I'm going to make posters. I'm going to make hats and shirts and whatever, a lunchbox. Like, it was a point where I was looking into lunchboxes.
Oh my God.
And I want to make, and there's still more. Like, I just got enamel pins in, or pins. They're not nice. Enamel pins, actually. Okay. But I just got pins in. The other thing that was important to me as a movie poster collector, I've been collecting mostly Mondo posters, but a lot of, you know, silkscreen movie posters, is I actually have a limited edition hand-pulled silkscreen version of the poster being printed right now, which is probably stupid because it's really expensive, but I wanted one, and the cost to make one was pretty close to the cost to make 100.
You might as well make them all.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, why not?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, if you're listening, like seriously, like, you guys don't hear me backing movies like this. Like really, I don't. Like, and when I get excited about a film, dude, you know me. Like, I don't get all, like, I don't spring a boner for every flick we talk about on the podcast. And, you know, and even if we have, like, someone involved with the film, you know, talking to us, like, I legitimately think this movie is worth checking out. You know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean. That's why
That's all I'm saying. Like, I don't know.
You were supposed to hate it, actually.
I know. I was expecting to hate this thing.
Like, I always figured that I would have to talk you into it, and then you would have to do the Sean, like, oh, I'll give it a rewatch.
I guess I'll check this out. Like, maybe when I'm, like, 45.
It was an okay movie.
I was expecting that exact. I was expecting the rewatch line.
it's seriously, man. It's a lot of fun. If like, we love these types of movies. Like, you nailed the aesthetic of the films without being like, without trying to copy it. And that's what I was saying. Like, you know, some people try to do these movies and they try to make it look exactly like an 80s film. Like, you made an 80s film, but it's a modern film, but it's an 80s film. Like, you know, it's its own thing, and it's really fun. And if you're into those films, you will have a lot to dig into in this film. You'll have a lot of fun with it. Watch it with a handful of friends. Like, you guys will have a fucking blast with this thing. And, you know, I want to see a sequel, man. I'm primed for a sequel.
Well, I'm writing one.
Oh God!
So
I just vinegar stroke.
Yeah, I did start writing. I had no intention of making one, but I just figured I got excited. Actually, I guess it's okay for me to be excited about it. Yeah, once the movie was done and I actually started playing festivals, I thought, man, maybe I could make a sequel. Why not? And then Slumber Party Massacre 2 just keeps ringing in my head. I'm like, oh, how cool would it be to make a ridiculous sequel that has nothing to do with the first? I mean, I'm not going to go that far. It's not going to be a musical.
Maybe they can actually get in the pool this time.
No one got in the pool. Like, except for Clay, right?
Clay jumped in. When he actually jumped in, it was 41 degrees outside and the pool was freezing. And then we didn't think we would still be shooting when summer came around, but we were. So we were able to shoot him swimming up to the edge during the summer. So yeah, in that scene, he's jumping in the pool in December and then over in June. But,
oh my God.
And then we were able to let Nancy gets in the water.
Right. Quickly. Okay, yeah.
And just, I had abandoned that from the script because I had to rewrite. In the original script, they're all in the water. And there's all this dialogue about not getting their hair wet, and they're on rafts and floaties. And then because of the temperature, every day I would, you know, check the pool as if it would suddenly warm up. And then I'd rewrite those day scenes and move everyone to a table or a chair. And then finally, since summer came around, we shot the one scene with Nancy and then found out that she didn't know how to swim.
Oh, like, wow.
If you watch it, if you for some reason watch it again, you can kind of see how awkward her swimming is. She didn't tell us until that day that she was not a strong swimmer.
That's great.
But yeah, maybe there'll be people in the pool in the sequel, but maybe not. Maybe that's my thing.
That's great. I don't know. Like maybe.
That's going to forever be my thing.
He's making these movies about pools, and like no one gets in the pool.
Yeah, or just keep making movies with titles that are complete lies.
Yeah. Sounds good to me. All right. Everyone, go to poolpartymassacre.com. You know what to do. Grab the flick. This gets the Screamcast, like, you know, 100% recommendation. Like, grab this shit. And we want Drew to make more movies, for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, if you have $20 to spare and you happen to like 80s slasher films and you're looking for one, please go buy a copy. If you don't like it, I will write you a handwritten apology letter and mail it to you. I'll even pay for the postage.
Nice. That's almost even worth it. There you go. A handwritten apology. All right. Gentlemen, let's dive into the next two segments really quick, and then we'll call it a show. Yeah?
Okay.
Sound good?
I am on board. Segments.
All right. Next up, let's jump into some stream screams.
Nate, wake up!
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
Don't fucking scream at me!
If you scream, I'll bring you back.
Don't scream, miss. Don't scream.
We're talking about the film Valentine from 2001.
Yeah.
And this is a 90s slasher that came out in 2001. I kept thinking that this was a straight up, like, right after Scream or something, like 1990, I don't know, 6 or 7. I don't even know when Scream came out.
He loves me.
Why is it that the one day of the year...
He loves me not.
Everyone is afraid to be alone.
He loves me.
Is Valentine's Day.
He loves me not. He loves me.
Hello? Someone
want to
be my Valentine?
But starring Denise Richards.
Oh my God! What? Is
yeah.
That? What did you do?
That was awful. Whatever that was awful.
That was kind of like a Predator noise.
Yeah, a little bit weird. Apologize. I can
Austin
do a Wookiee.
Powers bullshit.
There's that. How's that?
Sounded exactly the same.
Denise Richards and Catherine Heigl's in this, and she should have stuck to slashers. But anyway, Valentine, Brad, you made me watch
this.
This
is really, really fucking good right now.
Why did you make me watch this?
You're really talking people into it. All right, you're done.
You have talked about this for quite some time, and you finally found a way to make me watch this goddamn thing.
Yeah, I still stand by the 90s and early 2000s horror film. I think stuff from 1998 to about 2002, there was a wave of horror films that were good right after the whole Scream thing. And I think there's a lot of films that were trying to change horror. There was a lot of films just trying to do new things. And then some of them just stuck to their roots, but I think they were faulted, no matter what, just like we've had this conversation numerous times on the show, and just to quickly skim over it, is that if Valentine came out in 1986, we would be talking about how Scream Factory or Vinegar Syndrome needs to release it. It's in the same vein of every 80s slasher that you've seen. It has, you know, huge elements of course, My Bloody Valentine. It has huge elements from, like, Terror Train. I mean, it's total 80s, like, just slapstick, I guess more or less, like, schlocky shit that just happens. I mean, we have a
kid, young, who's going around asking young girls to dance at a high or middle school dance. He is the dork known as Jeremy Melton. Everybody turns him down. And then years later, as everybody's grown up, they start to die. But I mean, everything, step by step, even the cliches, I mean, this is totally an 80s slasher. And I just think this film got shit on so goddamn much. And it's fucking really good. Like, for, I mean, I'm talking about in vain of 80s slashers. And I.
No, it's actually, dude. I really, really had some fun with this.
It's a lot of fun.
Like, legit.
There's no difference between this and every 80s slasher. And let's come. No. And now, since we're the reason why we picked this film was because Drew's on the show. Because we wanted to pick slashers. So, Drew, what do you say?
So, first of all, somehow this movie just. I avoided this movie, or it was like under my radar when it came out. So I didn't see it until recently when people, I think it was last Valentine's Day, which I'm sure gets brought up every Valentine's Day, when suddenly it was like, every Valentine's Day people bring this movie up. I should probably check it out. And it's everything you just said. It really, if it was made in the 80s, it would be considered.
It'd be considered a classic. Yeah. Easily.
But it's just so 90s that
it's a soundtrack. It's a soundtrack.
We have fucking Static X. All I got
Static X and Orgy on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I mean, it's laughable now. It's like fucking playing Crazy Town or something at a party. You're like, what the fuck are we doing? You know, it's that that late 90s, early 90s,
like cross club scene,
crossover 90s industrial music that came out. And that's what was hot at the time. It was to sell soundtracks, but it was up at the film. But man, like I want somebody, like I want Steve Moore from Zombie to take this movie and rescore it. And I bet you changes it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's the main issue. I mean, other than the score actually sounds very reminiscent, like, of course, the soundtrack, the songs that play in the film, but just take the score in general, it's very reminiscent to Scream, which is not done by, who's the composer of Scream? It's not the same guy, but it's very, very, it's not Graham Revell, is it? No, Graham Revell didn't do Scream. Don't tell me. I heard you typing.
That's the wrong guy.
I heard someone typing.
Music by Don Davis.
Don Davis did Valentine.
I'm trying to see what else he did as far as a composer
He's somewhat of a well-known composer. He's done a lot.
The Matrix
composer.
Reloaded, Animatrix,
yeah,
Jurassic Park 3.
But anyways,
House on Haunted Hill.
Okay. This movie's not about fucking Don Davis. But it's
Sequest 2032.
But the score is very reminiscent to kind of the score in Scream. But I really think what really takes everybody out is when like they're at the club scene and fucking Static X is playing, and you're like, wait,
yeah,
I hate this fucking song. Like, why is this playing? But yeah, I mean, honestly, but it's, I mean, even the plot of, but the kills are fucking cool. I mean, the whole setup to the film is really neat, you know? It has everything.
I just need to ask, and I don't know if and this is like one of the beginning, the first, parts of the film where, we're past the 1988 shit. We're into quote unquote modern times, right? And the girl's she works in a hospital or a morgue or something like that.
She's becoming a doctor, surgeon or something.
She's become, okay. So obviously someone's in the room with her. There's a cadaver on the table. She gets ready to do a surgical thing and she notices the cadaver moves. And then we realize the killer's in the room with her. Did the killer strip down naked and lay on the table just to scare her? And then... within like 15 seconds, put his clothes on, including a trench coat, black pants, and some boots, and a mask?
Yeah.
Like, within... Seriously?
Yeah.
Hey, That's my one problem.
You want also what happens? Michael Myers gets shot in the fucking face in Halloween 2, but that bitch still fucking rides and slashes. Jason is brought back through a fucking pole in his fucking chest and gets resurrected through a lightning bolt. And the bitch goes to hell and space. This is totally a lot more believable than any of that shit that we love and we cherish. But that's the thing. It's
done in
2000. Like, it's one of those things where, you know.
It's pretty convoluted.
No, it's not. It's not, because I tell you what, man. Like I said, if this happened in the 80s, you would never ask that question, because we had so much other crazier shit happen in the 80s that you don't have to give your suspension of disbelief for something like that. Yeah. The only question I have is that why was his stomach blue?
Yes.
You know?
The lighting?
No, it's fucking a cadaver. It was cold. You know? But honestly, man, I mean, we have Michael Myers get shot in the fucking face and burned. You know, Donald Pleasance is in an explosion, and all he comes back is with a little scar on his face and a limp. We cherish Halloween. Yeah. I love Halloween. I love Friday the 13th. I love all of that. So when shit like that happens in Valentine, I don't even fucking raise a brow. It's like, all right, you know, it's just a gag.
Here's what I loved, though, and what really did creep me out, was the mask with a combination of the nosebleed. Like, I when I was younger and I'm in Southern California now, but I used to live in Iowa. And when we moved to the Midwest, all of a sudden every winter, because it would get so dry and cold, I would get nosebleeds, and it would happen like during school. So like, I'm terrified, I'm terrified of, like, I have nightmares of like my teeth falling out. I have, you know, the nosebleed thing is another thing that really creeps me out. So the combination of that was like, with that baby mask, was just so, like, such a fantastic Cupid. And creepy image. It's Cupid, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's Cupid mask.
I'm surprised that that hasn't reached levels of, say, like, the Michael Myers, or, cause there's some pretty amazing imagery there. I mean, I would love to see a poster, you know, with that mask and the nosebleed. That would be fucking amazing, you know, like, this movie has some visually iconic moments in it, and as much shit as it gets, I mean, you guys have said, I see people talking about this movie every now and then, and Brad, you've championed it, and I've always kind of blew it off because so many other people blow it off, but there's some fantastic slasher moments in this, even in that beginning scene that I was just describing. I love when a killer has like a knife and they just violently are just stabbing that knife down. There's something about that. We just talked about Dark Waters last week. There's a scene where the killer just stabbing down with his knife. I know that it happens in the Halloween remakes as well, but like, there's something like just visceral.
Fucking gunshots. Rob Zombie added gunshots after that shit. It sounded like.
Oh shit.
But
I mean, there's just something visceral about that imagery that I feel like Valentine gets. And I mean, it's entertaining, you know, I don't know. And Denise Richards is in it, and she gets into a
bikini. But I tell you what, man, I tell you what, though, is one thing that I always loved about Valentine that one ups a lot of slashers is kind of the non-cliché killings that happen. And I kind of get a tiny bit spoilery here. In the beginning, though, when he's going through the body bags, how many movies have we seen where the person is underneath the thing and then pushes it out and runs? Like, where the actual victim is. And when it's revealed, you're like, holy shit, that was, like, that's unexpected to me. Like, I expect that person to be underneath one of the tables, hiding, and, or hits the killer last second before, you know, it opens up the body bag. Like, there's so many different cliche things that could have happened. With what actually did happen, that was shocking. I mean, and also for the killer to kill in, you know, a populated area, you know, a nice, hey, not a pool, but there was a spa with a little bit of Slumber Party Massacre in there.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah. So,
dude, that scene
but again,
ridiculous.
What you think is going to happen, it does change a little bit. You kind of don't expect that. And that's what I've always really liked about Valentine. And it, you know, I got to give my pat myself on the back. Because even Edge of the Axe, how these movies are set up as far as, like, what happens, it's like, holy fucking shit, you know? Like, it has that, you know, I can't reference another movie because that kind of gives it away. We'll say it off the air. You know, it has that mentality to try. I mean, this movie really does try to surprise you and keep you guessing. And a lot of 90s movies, 2000s movies, stuff that's coming out today doesn't do that.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a fun slasher, and I definitely think it's unfairly shat upon.
Oh, totally. It infuriates me to no end, because, like, I understand people's beef with certain, you know, certain horror films, but it's like this one's just completely, like, they just look over. I mean, Jamie Blanks, the director of this film, made Urban Legend, which I thought at the time was really great. It doesn't hold up all that well.
It's on my rewatch list.
But it has a really good setup. It has a cool plot device. It's just certain things about the film kind of just don't hold up. But it's still a good film. Then he made Valentine, and then another slasher that he did in like 2003 or 2007 maybe. I can't remember, but it's called Storm Warning. And that's really fucking good. It looks to me like Jamie and fucking Urban Legend was an 80s slasher, like begging to be an 80s slasher. I mean, the setup to that film, the dialogue, the reveal, everything about that film is just screaming 80s. I think Jamie Blanks just did not. He was born in the wrong fucking decade. I mean, if this dude was fucking making movies in the fucking 70s and 80s. I don't want to sound like I know I'm going to get like a lot of tweets after I say this, but I would say that he would be up there with some of the greats because he would have had more movies. He would have had more movies. He would have had a bigger career.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like he's doing some scoring, you know, music and stuff like that now, but
right. No, I think he really did have it. I think he had what 80s slashers were, you know, the whole thing was built on. I think he had that and he applied that to the 90s. Movies were semi-successful because that was the Scream craze, you know? Mm. I think he saw Scream and was like, hey, this is what I've always wanted to fucking do. And, you know, he made it. I think he just went about it wrong. He should have shot it with his friends, pressed his own disc, released it, you know, been on our show.
Yeah, he could have been on your show.
So.
No, like I said, Valentine is streaming in HD. I think you can rent it from most digital rental outlets. I watched it on Vudu for a few bucks. You can buy it in HD. And no, I'm full. You know, Brad, like I'm surprised I'm liking shit that you've recommended.
I mean, because it's not fucking Bayformers.
I know. But no, Valentine definitely. I think definitely worth your time if you want to watch a slasher you haven't seen.
Drew, any words on Valentine?
Any final words, sir?
I just actually because I rewatched it for you. I rewatched it for you.
Mm.
I liked it even more. I liked it even with that Catherine Hyde. The opening scene with the body bags just reminded me how great it was.
Yeah,
and it wasn't. And it wasn't cliche. Like you were saying, you expect someone to be underneath. In my mind, you expect them to get away whenever there's a killer kicking in all the bathroom stalls or whatever it is looking for the person.
Exactly, yeah.
It always ends with the person getting away. And in this one, I don't know if that's a spoiler, but
no, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
the beginning of the movie, but
it goes against the cliches, and it's really surprising.
Yeah, and he created really good tension in this with, you know, when the killer was stalking his victims and stuff. I was impressed.
Yeah,
and I like the Denise Richards death scene in the hot tub.
It's fantastic.
I don't know exactly why. I there's just something funny about the. Like, ah, fuck it, I'll just throw the drill in.
No, it's a fucking great
Where
moment.
The hell did he get that drill? It's so funny, it reminded me, I thought about Pool Party Massacre during that scene. I was like, where did that drill come from?
It's near the basement.
Well, I thought about Pool Party Massacre because I thought, how long did he get an extension cord to?
There's some logistics you need to think about when you're using power tools to kill someone.
Oh, definitely, definitely, but I appreciate it.
Fantastic!
So all right, I think Valentine's extremely underrated. So you need to watch it if you like slasher films, man.
Is there a version with some special features?
Just the DVD. It was never made it on Blu-ray.
No, okay.
Yeah, it looks pretty damn good, man. In HD, streaming at least. Like, it looked really, really good. There's some really cool, like I said, soundtrack aside, like, there's some cool, like, cinematography in it. Cinematography. I'm blaming the bourbon right now. Some good cinematography in it, and it's worth checking out for sure.
Yeah, the only thing I do know about the film is that there was a very, very hard, like, X rating, or not X rating, a very hard R rating for the film that was very, like, kind of hyper-violent, that Jamie Blank said on the commentary, but that has never been seen the light of day, so...
Huh. See, I think it would benefit from more of an edge to it. Because I kept thinking it was PG-13.
Hey, and it's shot on fucking 35 too, man.
No, it looks good.
Yeah, and it looks good. That needs a fucking, you know, restoration, I think. Not restoration, but a scan, yeah. I think. The thing is, all these fucking movies are shown, it's something I would do. I'd track down a fucking print of Valentine. Bet that she looks badass on screen. Because it's a pretty movie, too, you know? It's very colorful. Yeah. You know, it plays off the reds and stuff like that. You know, plays off the seasonal holiday. I think it's good, man. I just don't understand the hate for it.
Lots of turtlenecks.
Goddamn turtlenecks. All right, moving right along, you guys. Let's jump into VHS.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Did you do the vinegar stroke?
Vinegar stroke just happened.
The key.
Well, here we are at last. Right where we ought to be. Video.
Oh my God!
This is a 1988 film called Edge of the Axe.
Made for TV, by the way.
Six women, one man, all dead. Edge of the Axe. Gerald's a cool kid with a keen computer. Now that he's met Lillian, the lines of communication are definitely open.
It's called Icarus. You can ask it anything you like.
But the readout spells trouble.
Wait a minute, what happened here?
And murder is the mode.
What shape is that body?
Hamburger meat.
A killer is loose, and the whole town's on edge. Edge of the Axe.
Gerald, why do you have the names of all the women who were killed in your computer file?
Who's Charlie?
He's my cousin. The other night I asked my computer to check the hospitals to find my cousin. And they released him from a mental hospital 2 years ago in Patterson.
You know, you're going to get in trouble and you're going to have microchips for brains.
The situation is terminal. Can Lillian deprogram the killer before he catches his next victim? Edge of the Axe. It's a great night for bad dreams.
Made for TV by Jose Ramon Larraz.
Wow.
That was
really
Joseph
good.
Bronstein.
That was really good. I'm very impressed.
Now, Brad, I was unable to track this down through my various means. This is a VHS flick, as the segment describes. This is a VHS, oh my God. Films that are on VHS, stuck on VHS, that need to be resurrected. And Edge of the Axe, like, I love the title. And I watched the trailer, and it looks right up my alley. Brad,
did you see that GIF that I sent you?
Yeah, dude.
That fucking shit's brutal as fuck.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Drew, did you end up seeing this?
I didn't, unfortunately. I did watch the trailer several times, got really excited about it,
yeah.
And then also was unable...
Yeah, unfortunately, this movie is very, very rare.
I'm shocked that this isn't even, like, on YouTube. Like, normally, like, films like this, you can at least find... Yeah, some horrible VHS rip on YouTube, but it's not even there. So obviously it tells me that some major studio must own the rights to this.
No, it's a foreign film.
It's no one fucking knows about this.
I would go more or less that it got lost in rights because it was, a Spanish production. It was a made for TV movie. So if anybody
to sell me on Edge of the Axe
for our hardcore, very hardcore film fans, if you remember 1970s, there is a couple films, Symptoms, which was released from Mondo Macabro on Blu-ray recently last year, and Vampires. Both of those films are directed by this dude, Joseph Larraz. Also did a movie called Black Candles that was pretty popular, what I call the iconic kind of monster movie called Rest in Pieces as well, which is another hard-to-find flick. But in the late 80s, Joseph Larraz did Edge of the Axe. It was originally a made-for-TV Spanish film. That made its way over here on VHS only, has never seen the light of day other than that. And I think it was one of those things that got quickly, dismissed because of the white face on the front, where it was just another Jason or Michael Myers film. But Edge of the Axe has a lot of things going for it. Number one, which I've kind of hinted at, was the surprise with as far as the reveal of the killer and how everything pans out in the film. It's definitely way before its time, I feel. There's even chat between computers with two people. One is one house, one is the other, and they're just instant messaging on their computer, and the computer talks to them, which is very, very weird. It's not like science sci-fi at all. It's just a very odd thing of the film. But I mean, we open up with just this woman in a car, car wash, and just right in broad daylight, we have our killer with the white mask and the axe just smash the front window and just axe this woman to death. The kill scenes are sometimes very violent. I mean, when you have an axe bringing it down on somebody, it could go one or two ways. You could shy away from the axe, into the person and do one swipe like most horror films do, or you could have what this guy does where he just fucking keeps hitting you. With it. There's a sequence, which was the GIF I sent you, where he traps somebody in a house and the woman basically comes to a dead end and he hits her like once in the back and then she turns around and tries to stop the axe and then he hits her in her arms and then her like wrists break and then he just keeps like going and he's hitting her in her shoulders and then she falls down and he keeps hitting her in her back. It's a really fucking violent scene, you know?
How is this made for TV, then?
It's foreign. I mean, it's not shown on fucking ABC. Like, this is a foreign cinema, man. I mean, the ratings don't apply the same. You know, they didn't have...
You crazy Spanish people.
So, but I mean, as far as like that, it's not, you know, it's still in English. It was just that Spanish production, you know, made for Spain at the time. And that wasn't released theatrically over here. Got one VHS release from a small sub-label that doesn't, you know, wasn't really well-known. And just kind of, and it's just disappeared since then. And it's a shame. Because, I mean, it really does have a lot of things going for it. I mean, it has a really great killer. It has some very intense scenes. You know, it does have this one little musical breakdown that I love. It's these two guys that are in, no, it's not like a musical, like song and dance or anything, but it's these two guys in a truck. And, he's like, hey man, you know that girl Maria? He's like, yeah, she's a fine fox. And he's like, I got a song for her. And he's like, what is it? He's like, Maria, Maria, you so sweeter. I want to play with your titas. And I fucking crack up. It's just so goofy. But it has the charm to it too, because it has some really, like, I mean, quote unquote in the air, well-developed characters for a slasher film. And another thing, you don't hate anybody. You don't have a group of kids that you really despise, that you don't care whether they live or die. You really do just have a maniac on the loose that's chopping up people and they're trying to find out who it is. So, I mean, it like I said, all those elements in play, it's a fucking decent slasher, you know? It's not boring at all. It keeps its pace pretty it keeps trucking, you know? It keeps you entertained. There's no really downtime. And when the killer shows up, you're kind of like, oh, fuck, you know, we're going to see something crazy fucking brutal again. And a lot of horror films don't keep that. I mean, we have like our kill in the beginning and then an hour break and then kills at the end, or kills so sporadic we kind of forget it's a slasher sometimes. So I think all, you know, and plus from the guy's filmography, I mean, take Black Candles alone, the cinematography from that. I mean, and of course, vampires. You know, very hypersexual, like, you know, vampire flick, very erotic, and Symptoms, which is super weird. And a couple of other films that I've seen that I can't really recall the titles of right now. But I mean, he's a decent filmmaker. This is towards the end of his career, but, you know, it wasn't like one last hurrah or he was getting close to being done. He just started making some, you know, horror films because of the market, obviously. He was able to dish out a few more after the 70s and early 80s. Made a couple before he was done, and he achieved it. And it's just a shame that both of those, rest in even Black Candles. I know Black Candles got a Blu-ray release earlier last year, later last year.
Red.
Yeah. But, oh, we need to talk about that too. Thank you for mentioning Code Red.
I need to buy that.
Yeah, it's really good. And then he had Rest in Pieces, which is, kind of hard to find. But yeah, if you can track down a VHS copy of, Edge of the Axe, it's literally nowhere to be found out there, even on the interwebs. It's crazy.
So yeah, when you start,
there's one on Amazon.
What is it going for?
$50.
Yeah, it's pretty rare. That's what I'm saying. It's not a very well known movie. It's you know, and it's on a VHS label. I can't remember what it is, but it's not well known at all. So
what I want to ask you before we close this out, Brad, is like, is this? Because generally slashers are following a bunch of teens in a cabin or in a location. Is this have the teen element or is this different?
No, it has kind of a Forum Home Video. I don't know who the fuck that was. It has a couple. It does kind of do farm, like Friday the 13th aspect. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, it has the, even the cover looks like a fucking Friday the 13th ripoff, which obviously that's what the company was going for. There is a shot very close to that in the film, but I mean, it does have those elements. It does take place in a kind of rural country. And with barns and farmhouses and stuff, but it's not, when you watch it, you're not like, oh, this is definitely Friday the 13th. You just kind of, it doesn't utilize the location. It's just where the characters are.
Okay.
You know, like in fucking Friday the 13th, that you know they're in cabins because they talk about cabins. You know, they're in the cabins that look like cabins. These are just like homes and farmhouses and shit.
All right. So, very cool.
But you were going to ask me in the beginning how I saw this movie. I originally rented this. I don't know how far Albertsons went as far as a chain. Did you have any Albertsons?
Yeah, we have Albertsons out here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Albertsons used to rent videos and tapes.
Used to, yes.
Yeah, way back when. And there was a location in Winter Haven, you know, where I used to live in Florida. Still live in Florida, but just not in Winter Haven. They had this on the shelf, and when they started going out of business as far as like tapes and stuff, we don't have Albertsons around here anymore. They all went out, but they started doing away with their rentals. That's how I picked this up. So I've had the tape for shit, man, like probably 20 years.
Well, we need to somehow start demanding this film, at least a DVD release or something. Because, I mean, the director, like I said, I mean, he has a fucking track record. Yeah. Symptoms, Vampires, Black Candles. I mean, that's nothing to ignore. So it'd be nice if this was more accessible. So.
Yeah.
If you're listening, start asking all of the labels, everyone, if they've heard of this movie and if they're gonna be releasing it.
No,
at least get a at least get some visibility on it for sure.
Yep, that's not happening.
I mean, who knows? The master could be lost, but at least we can get some people to start looking
for
it.
And that's kind of what I've came up with. So that's the bad part. And there's being it's wasn't distributed theatrically. There's no there's no prints of it either. There were apparently what I've read is that there were. Prints distributed in Spain, but there were very, very few. Like I said, it was a made-for-TV movie. So the master might exist, but from what I've tried to discover, it's not around. Unfortunately, the director is dead.
Yeah, he passed away in 2013.
But I did speak briefly to Pete Toombs, about it, and the rights aren't an issue. It's mainly just the print.
Gotcha.
So, because I believe, with further research, these things are in public domain.
Yeah.
So,
well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for sure.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
Without having to fly to Florida.
I know, huh?
That's how I'm trying to get you here. This is all right, so the real reveal's been done. I really want you to watch this movie with me, Drew.
Well, let's talk off of that. I have a list of demands that I've prepared.
Okay. I'll let you guys sort that out. All right. Well, I think it's going to do it for this week's episode. Drew, man, thank you for hanging out and bullshitting with us. Thanks for shedding some light on Pool Party Massacre.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh, wait. Oh. I forgot the.
Oh, shit. What's up?
All right. So I didn't send this to you, Sean, but I sent this to Drew. So I posted, because we wrote a small little thing about Pool Party Massacre on our website. Well, I posted it on the Code Red forum, and Bill Olson replied to it, and this is his this is him speaking.
That's fantastic.
Typing. Cover isn't really good? ? Digital movie? ? Cover really isn't good, Drew? Is it? Is it good?
I feel like he was asking me if it was good because there's a question mark.
Yeah. So
and the answer is yes.
Cover's fucking awesome. Are you kidding me? It's a lady, this girl in a bikini with a skull face and two eyes in her fucking martini. Come on!
But is the cover really isn't good? God, dude, Bill cracks me up, dude. He's so crazy.
Yeah, when you sent that to me, I laughed out loud when I saw that.
Oh, shit. I love it. Amazing. All right.
Awesome. So Drew, what are you scheming up next? Are you scheming anything up, or are you just trying to recoup all the money you've lost?
I mean, I'm certainly with just in case my wife is listening, I'm definitely focusing on recouping all the money I've lost. I have another film that I'd like to start shooting soon, and it's a revenge horror, and it'll be a similar budget as to Pool Party Massacre.
$11 this time? You're going to stay true to what you said?
I'm going to stick to that $11 for sure. And so I'd love to start shooting that soon. I'm writing the sequel to Pool Party Massacre, but really self-distributing is a full-time job I've found out. And so, you know, and plus with all the PR and trying to keep up with social media, I mean, I try to respond to every single post and email, and you know, I'm so grateful if somebody actually purchases the movie or even watches the movie with a friend or anything, that I want to make sure that I thank everyone, and that's not easy to do. So it's been monopolizing all my time.
Very nice. Well, like we've said throughout the episode of Sucking Drew's Dick here, we're just gonna call it Screamcast 135, Sucking Drew's Dick. The
no,
title.
Man, I think it's like, you know,
no,
I really need to come up with seriously something more clever. Like,
I will.
Oh yeah, there we go. Slumber Party Massacre or Pool Party Massacre. Total bank job. Dude, sequel.
No, that's it. That's
sequel
it.
Subtitle.
That's going to be the title.
Oh, actually, it's funny. I've been trying to come up with one.
Yeah.
And that's the. There's a piece of paper in front of me on my desk, and the only thing I've written down in this whole 2 hours is total bang jobs with three exclamation points. So
it's apparently on.
It's stuck.
All right.
We just found it.
Listeners of the Screamcast, you have a job to do. You have a job to do right now. Is go to poolpartymassacre.com. Buy Pool Party Massacre and convince everyone else to buy this thing as well. I think I can in full confidence say that you guys will have a blast with this, and definitely support indie horror. And you know, it's always, like I've said before, it's always refreshing when an indie horror movie turns out to be just something that I adore, and Pool Party Massacre is one of them. So Drew, thank you for spending time with us and again, you know, talking with us about the flick.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, and I'm glad you guys liked it. I honestly had no idea if anyone would like it but me. And then I turned out that I don't even like it that much, so then I got really worried. But I just can't watch. I can't watch it anymore.
Oh man, you've watched it. You've probably watched it so many times. It's done. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Brad and I have a hard enough time listening back to our own podcast. I couldn't even imagine making a movie.
Yeah, exactly. So I got discouraged right before the release, but I'm glad that it's found a little bit of an audience, and there's some people out there that get it and get what I was trying to do, and see that some of the flaws were intentional. Not all of them. I'm not going to lie. But some of them were, and it's hopefully people enjoy it.
I think you have something to be proud of, man. Really, seriously, as a fan of horror, as a fan of fun 80s horror, like, you have something you definitely should be proud of here. And, you know, I'm so pumped I got to, I'm glad I loved it. I'm glad I had the, you know, was able to watch and love it. So, all right. Oh shit! I gotta thank all our sponsors, right?
Oh shit! Yeah, because that's you know.
Well, we've given GrindhouseVideo.com some massive promotion today. I mean, Drew exclusively buys his movies from grindhousevideo.com.
True
story. So you should too. Shop where the cool people shop.
And I think you can purchase Pool Party Massacre from Grindhouse Video, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Hey, and if you go into the store, they rent movies out now. Holy shit.
Crazy.
Insanity. He's insane. next up, Coffee Shop of Horrors. If you go to coffeeshopofhorrors.com, grab your favorite bag of coffee.
Thank you, Coffee Shop of Horrors, for giving us millions.
I love their coffee. And
you're not getting paid millions? I am.
Oh, you are? God damn it.
Yeah.
Use the code SCREAMCAST to get 10% off your order. Damn good coffee. A lot of fun. I love, for me, call me shallow. Packaging.
Hey, shallow Sean.
Go a long way. And their designs and their coffees. The designs are fantastic, really fun. The names are really fun. But the coffee, and I should know, because I'm a maniac, I love some coffee. The coffee's damn good. So check them out. CoffeeShopOfHorrors.com.
Really good plug.
Thank you to Wolfman of Mars for providing the music for the show. And thank you to Kevin Spencer for providing our visual look. InkSpatters.com is dead, but we will let you know once his new website rises from the depths of the grave.
Hell.
He did just design my new logo for the AXPX podcast, by the way.
We're talk about AXPX podcast.
And finally, big thanks to Vinegar Syndrome for being a sponsor of the show. We do have a Vinegar Syndrome extravaganza coming up very soon. And stick around for more information on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Vinegar Syndrome, for the billions of dollars.
And of course, you know, I've gotten this whole show, man. I haven't plugged our Patreon. No new patrons this week. I'm not going to be.
That's right.
We're going to be depressed about that.
We're not making millions or billions.
I'm not going to cry myself to sleep. But we do want to thank all of our patrons for donating their hard-earned cash to us each month. When BJ does come back, she should have a brand new microphone. That is because of you. You guys. You provided that. And of course, you'll provide, hopefully keep the money coming in. We'll keep the show sounding great with the use of, our little program thing to make the show sound amazing. So, check that out. Patreon.com/scream_cast. We have $1, $3, $5 levels. $5 levels will get our After Dark podcast, which should be coming very soon. We promise.
CUMMING.
All right. Drew, where can people find you online? Other than poolpartymassacre.com.
Yeah, poolpartymassacre. All of the social medias, I'm lucky enough to have a name that was available. So just at Drew Marvick.
Damn.
Everywhere. Or at Pool Party. Feel free to follow Pool Party Massacre too. It's really, spoiler, it's really me posting, just so you know.
You have a staff of dozens?
No, but sometimes I'll have a conversation with my personal account to give that impression. And, you know.
You do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
All right, of course, all of our social media links over at thescreamcast.com, as well as articles plugging Pool Party Massacre by Brad.
Yes.
We'll talk to all of you guys next. We'll talk to all of you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.
But it's just a way to get people to buy it.
Or rent it.
Excuse me. Dude, it's fucking like 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning over here, so give me a break.
Geekbeats.net has been your one-stop shop for all things geek for years. But there's a side to them many of you have never heard. The subscription side. Subscribe and listen to great podcasts like The Breakfast Pub, The Original Gentleman, and the Watch a Movie With Us series. Head on over to oneofus.net and don't forget your towel.